Takeaway with MES. This series follows a group of students and industry experts as they join forces to create a flying taxi, or eVTOL. I'm your host, Niraj, and this is a chat I had with Tim Kelly, founder of the MEF. The MEF is a manufacturing network on the Sunshine Coast. Tim also founded the eVTOL student team. He is an internationally experienced aeronautical engineer, now also turned social entrepreneur, amongst other things. So without further ado, let's take it away.
We're trying to come up with a way, like, you imagine if you're explaining what an eVTOL is to, how old is Charlotte now?
Nine,
okay. Although Charlotte is probably more advanced than most kids' age, I would say.
Oh, let's not give her too much credit.
She's not, yeah.
No.
Yeah, so if you were trying to explain what an eVTOL is to Charlotte, how would you explain it?
Flying car.
Fantastic.
Yeah, because most people, you say eVTOL, and you're like, all right, you know, can we do less acronyms?
Mm.
And it's like, all right, electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicle. All right, I still don't even know, can we do this in English? Mm. And then you're like, flying taxi. And they're like, okay, all right, well, that's something but that's totally Jetsons.
Yeah.
It's like George Jetson. And it's like, yeah, well, not really, but kind of. Anyway, yeah, I think, I don't know, people seem to understand the concept of the flying car. The other thing I think is most people say, well, that's just a drone. And it's like, well, not really, because most drones typically, in most contexts at least, generate all their lift via thrust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only way that they really do it. So they fly, but they don't. You know, it's hyper inefficient from an energy perspective to fly using thrust.
Mm.
That's what wings are for. And most drones don't make that transition. They don't use, you know, a propulsion system for vertical takeoff and landing, and then somehow transition that into something for forward flight that generates lift using wings. So when we get asked, well, isn't that just a big drone? It's like, well, kind of, but also not really.
So it's sort of, it sounds like sort of a mix between a conventional aircraft and a drone, essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
So, and then walking through the process of just big picture from start to finish, like from A to B, what that vehicle is actually doing.
Yeah, right. So the intent is that, you know, someone, let's say that there's an organization that buys a fleet of air taxis, and they run those air taxis like you would run a fleet of cars or buses or whatever. And there's a specific piece of infrastructure that, you know, which is the port, and it's ideally a network of nodes within a certain proximity of each other. And the user would have an app, much like Uber,
mm-hmm.
and you wouldn't summon, but you would book in, I guess, a ride on it, and then you'd travel to that place. You know, ideally it wouldn't be far. Ideally it'd be nice and close.
Yep.
Maybe you could walk or ride a bike or something to it. And then it flies you from point A to point B, and you get out and go on your merry way, and it takes the next passenger from that node to wherever they need to go.
And the nodes don't require runways because the thing can take off.
Yeah, it's like it'd be like a network of helipads, basically. And I think the idea would be that this would be backwards compatible with existing helipad infrastructure. Mm. But I think, you know, there's a fair bit that needs to be resolved around charging, fast charging, and hot swappable batteries and whatever the method is to maximize the uptime of the vehicle. Because I think it's going to be pretty important to try to get the cost per trip down as low as possible. And in today's dollar terms, I think for a half an hour trip, that's, you know, maybe 100 Ks or so, that needs to be sub $100. Mm. Ideally, it'd be something like $50. That's potentially a little bit too cheap, but I think it's a good target to have. I think the idea of going from here to Brisbane for $50 is pretty compelling in a lot of ways.
And so we've heard talks about, say, autonomous cars. Musk was doing his boring company, trying to go underground, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
What's different with the eVTOL? As a whole, obviously it's flying for the air, but I guess is it better as a form of transport? Is it better for the environment? Is it part of the same thing, part of the same infrastructure?
I think it's significantly better than what cars are for the moment in terms of contribution to emissions, obviously, because it's electric.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also it's probably going to be better than even what EV cars would be, considering it needs significantly less infrastructure to manage. The autopilot piece is, again, simpler and more proven for aircraft than road vehicles are. I mean, dealing with the plethora of other human-controlled vehicles and pedestrians and the complexity of road networks, even though for an aircraft there's a whole, you know, there's a third axis involved. It's, you know, it's
you're literally like adding another dimension, etc.
Yeah, isn't it? Well, yeah. And in a lot of ways, you could almost say that there's another three, because for a car, there's you know, the X and Y,
mm-hmm.
and also rotation about Z.
Yep.
Because
which is your up turning. Down.
Yeah. Yep. Right. And then for an aircraft, of course, you've got all 6 degrees of freedom that you now need to manage.
Yeah.
I think the so from an infrastructure perspective, and from an like an especially from an artificial intelligence perspective, I think probably the air taxis or EV tolls are simpler. I think the really, really hard part about it is the safety aspect in terms of fail safes and catastrophic events. Mm. So if you compare, even from what I understand, autonomous electric vehicles now, if everybody converted over today, that's going to be significantly safer
mm-hmm.
than having people behind the wheel for the most part. So there'd already be less lives lost through that transition if it was possible to make it, which, you know, it's not. I think if you then compare that to a fleet of eVTOLs, even if we got the failure rate down to, you know, 1 × 10⁻⁹
mm-hmm.
failures.
Which is 1 in a billion.
Yeah, 1 in a billion, something like
first
that.
More.
That's per trip, you yeah. know, and there's going to be a lot of trips. And every now and again, there's going to be something that doesn't go right.
Mm.
Even if you've got, you know, ridiculously high levels of safety built into it. And that's where probably parachutes that are coupled to, you know, a pyrotechnic charge or something like that, mm. like a lot of what goes on in a lot of general aviation these days.
Yeah. You're talking about those parachutes that are installed on light, very light aircraft.
Correct.
Yep.
Yeah.
Ballistic yep. parachutes, essentially.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah. One of the things I think about an aircraft that is fixed wing as well is that if there is, for whatever reason, a power outage, it still has the ability to be able to glide.
True. Yep.
Whereas a traditional drone, which whereby all the lift is generated by the thrust,
yep.
no thrust is no lift equals, and then you've got no control.
Yep.
Whereas if you've got either altitude and or forward airspeed, then generally speaking, you can do something. Same as with a helicopter. Mm. I mean, you know, they'll auto rotate and flare out when they get to the ground. But the fact that they've got altitude and they've got a you know, a rotor that's turning.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they can auto gyrate and
yeah, that's right.
Kind of glide down to earth.
Yep. Yeah, so I think that trying to find good alternatives for those 1 in a billion cases is still going to be really important. Because for a car, those 1 in a billion cases will still happen, but they're just often less critical.
Mm-hmm.
A brake failure, whilst it could be catastrophic, could still, you know, potentially not mean death of occupant because, you know, there's not an altitude involved. The speeds are generally sub 100 kilometers an hour, whereas for this we're talking ideally, you know, over 250 kilometers an hour. So I think there's a few things that need to be resolved there, and that's where both from a regulatory and a social acceptance piece it starts becoming pretty difficult because these eVTOLs with their size are going to be thought of synonymously with general aviation aircraft, and that's probably still the right thing to do because that's the best analogy that we have. But I think it's a little bit like comparing a very mature technology like internal combustion engines with electric vehicles and the argument around EVs being worse for the environment somehow because, you know, battery technology in terms of recycling isn't at a good level yet.
Yeah.
but you're comparing a technology that's, you know, more than 100 or 100 years old or whatever it is now to something that's really only, you know, a decade or so old.
Yeah.
And, of course, has an awful long way to go. And I think it would really be a similar thing for eVTOLs and air taxis. Once you get adoption at scale, the progression of that technology in the areas where it's potentially not as strong as it could be would be pretty swift.
Yeah. So what you're saying that with previous technologies like your internal combustion engines, et cetera, you've had a long time to invest both expertise and, mm-hmm. and resources, how mm-hmm. it's got to this level right yep. now, but your EV industry is still at its infancy, really.
Correct.
And yeah. you know, it's only by getting into it now that we're going to be able to reach that.
Yeah, correct.
Similar point at some point.
Yep. Ideally, the business case for it would make itself, you know, where there is increasing appetite for it. I think different countries will have different appetites for it. I mean, Australia being such a big country with a low population density, infrastructure for us is really expensive because we have to build a lot of infrastructure per kilometre per head of population relative to somewhere like the Netherlands, which is, you know, the infrastructure per population is really low in comparison. They get really good return on their invested infrastructure. So something like eVTOLs wouldn't make as much sense in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Like the train systems are great. You know, they've got a great culture around cycling. They don't use a lot of cars anyway. Mm. And when they do, the infrastructure is generally really good. We're in a pretty different situation here. There's an awful lot of urban sprawl. People spend an inordinate amount of time stuck in traffic or just traveling generally. And even just looking at our attempts to get high-speed rail up here onto the Sunshine Coast, it's been difficult. And even the high-speed rail is still only going to be, you know, maybe 160 kilometres an hour or something like that, probably if we're lucky. And it's going to cost billions and billions, like, I don't know, what, $20 billion, something like that.
And you still need the massive infrastructure
uh-huh.
for the rails. Because yeah. last time you were mentioning something that I found really interesting that I didn't think about before was that with regards to the environment, a lot of the costs associated with carbon emissions, a lot of the cost actually comes from the infrastructure
yeah.
rather than the actual vehicle emissions themselves.
Yeah. I don't know if those numbers I gave were 100%, but I remember reading about it. I can't remember what it was exactly. But I mean, I know that concrete produces 8% of global CO2 emissions every year.
Oh, yeah.
Just by itself.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what it is for asphalt and all that kind of stuff. But if you think about how much has to go into the building of infrastructure, the idea of having a set of nodes that are equipped to handle, you know, vehicles like air taxis, the infrastructure cost of that is just what, fractions of a percent relative to the infrastructure you would need for rail or for road, especially if you start talking about boring. Like, and don't get me wrong, like the technology that Musk's brought is phenomenal between SpaceX and Tesla and Boring Co. and Neuralink, and let's not talk about X because that's not going to work well for anybody.
I was waiting for that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not that it won't work. It's just, all right, well, but what's the cost? Like the cost per kilometre of that is insane. And for a city where it's really high density, especially for somewhere like Los Angeles, you probably wouldn't want heaps of air taxis flying around. It's probably not a great idea. I think for me, I would want to see air taxis used in the right environments as something that complements other forms of transport. So it shouldn't be a direct replacement for any of them. They all have their purposes. But I think that if you just continue investing in the one mode of transport over and over, you just get diminishing returns on it because it has its strengths and weaknesses. And air taxis, eVTOLs will have their strengths and weaknesses too. And I think that they'll fill a pretty unique gap in what, you know, particular mission profile, if you like, in terms of transportation. And it'll unload other forms of transportation. And it should do that in a way that is pretty low cost in terms of infrastructure and and like on a per ride basis. So I think when a lot of people think, oh, air taxis, this is the future, they think about instead of everybody owning a car, they'll own an air taxi. Yeah. And it's certainly in the short term, unless there's like with the technology that we have and can see currently, for me, I don't really see that happening. I see it more as this network of you know, helipad type nodes and, you know, a relatively small number in the scheme of things of air taxis flying around. It's not really especially to begin with, it wouldn't be a mass transit.
I remember when we were still at HeliMods, we were talking, even back then, that was like 3 years or so ago,
mm-hmm.
you were talking about eVTOLs then.
Yep.
When did that idea originate? Did you come out of the womb just the first word being eVTOL? Or?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah, 40-something years ago, I was thinking about it. I don't know. Like, I think, you know, we had so much success recruiting through student teams, and we didn't have a student team up here on the Sunny Coast, and we weren't getting many students coming through from Sunny Coast Uni. And since starting the MEF and working a lot more with businesses and schools, you know, finding that businesses struggle to get the talent they wanted, and a lot of the talent, you know, when it finished school, would leave the area, mm. and it would go to Brisbane or ACT or Melbourne or Sydney or whatever for study. And that was just, you know, fueling a lot of that problem. And advanced any cluster really is predicated on a critical mass of talent. And unless we turned that around, you know, it just wasn't. We weren't really going to get there. We'd always be missing a pretty key ingredient.
Yeah, well, the whole eVTOL thing, when did you start thinking about that?
Yeah, I guess it does. What's the best way to answer that? So I started thinking about it probably about 3 years ago. And, you know, as an aeronautical engineer and yourself included, it's probably something that we've all thought about it at some point. I think what was different this time was specifically the student team aspect. Like the idea of going out and trying to raise capital against this idea as a commercial venture it's not how I operate. I really wanted it to be something that had strong education industry preparation elements to it. So when we did finally convince and when I say we, it was very much a combination of people at the uni and myself convincing the uni to get on board with it. When that finally did start getting traction, and we started talking about, well, what should it be? And we had a bit of a think about, well, you know, what are the skill sets that we have? What's going to be compelling for the students? What's a problem that hasn't been solved yet? Not being solved yet, of course, that implies potential for large impact innovation, which is, I think, important. We don't want to be shooting for, you know, let's make a new toothbrush.
Mm.
We wanted to be doing something that
you could probably do with one.
Thank you.
Yeah,
good. Yeah, right back at you.
That was the best comeback, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
Well, you too.
Yeah, that's right. So we wanted a project that ticked all of those boxes. And we had a look at solar cars and you know, suborbital sounding rockets and Formula SAE and a lot of those types of things. But the eVTOL was the one that seemed to resonate the most for everybody, which was good. And I certainly, you know, they wanted. The idea was that I would lead the project, and I feel a lot more comfortable doing that with an eVTOL than I do with a Mars rover or, you know, or a Formula SAE vehicle or anything like that.
Yes, because of your aeronautical background.
Yeah, just because of the background.
Yeah, and yeah. Talk a bit about your background. I know you've worked with the GSF. You've worked in a couple of different places, haven't you?
Yeah. So I was very lucky when I graduated. The Joint Strike Fighter program was going and a bunch of other programs are going. So there was really a bit of a worldwide shortage of aeronautical engineers. So that was how some of that work managed to trickle its way down to Australia, because often it won't. It'll just stay in America and Europe. And then through that program, I got sent to Los Angeles and Nashville, and I worked on the Sikorsky CH-53K for a while. And And then went to Germany and the Netherlands and worked on the Airbus A350 before coming back here to work with the good self at Helimods. And then finished up there in mid-2020 and started the Manufacturing Excellence Forum, where we roped you in again successfully.
Yeah, keep coming back.
Glutton for punishment.
And I met some of the mentors in there, Dylan being one of them, Anthony being the other one. Mm-hmm. My understanding that Dylan and yourself have worked together at some point, and Anthony and yourself have worked together at some point also. Yep. So you're trying to source, I guess, those mentors and all those industry partners within industry with people that you work with, or that people that are within the industry.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think I've been very lucky to work with a lot of, you know, very talented and very intelligent and just good humans generally over the years. And
I would have expected you to say except you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well, I mean, I was thinking about it, but I didn't want to throw you under the bus in public.
Sorry. For
a change.
I wasn't going to be the first time. Yeah,
that's right. And one of the good things about that is that you meet a bunch of people with a whole bunch of different skill sets.
Mm.
And, of course, like any program or any organization, it really needs a lot of good people with complementary skill sets, leveraging their skill sets in a complementary manner, so not trying to compete with each other, but genuinely actually trying to you know, put the, in this case, the vehicle at, as the head priority for them to make a difference on. And and you know, the response has been really good. Like we had, I don't know, 50 something students, probably 60% from the uni and 40% from local high schools. And then, you know, we've got the better part of 20 mentors. And to be fair, I haven't found, like, it's very early days, but we haven't really helped all of the mentors to engage to their full ability or capacity yet, but that'll come. You know, I think we've got to start somewhere. So, you know, starting with yourself and Anthony and Jake and Dylan and Tyler worked really, really well at the first session, which was great.
Yeah, how did that session go, by the way? You hadn't had to talk about it yet. So you set up the eVTOL student team and sort of invited everyone to that first session at the UniSC.
Yep.
And we were all in a room there. And then you sort of walked us through what the hell we're there for.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, and obviously there were a lot of people just thinking, what even is this thing and how is this going to work, and hopefully coming out of it.
Did you get a lot of skeptical looks at the start? People kind of like...
There wasn't too much skepticism. There was optimism.
Yeah.
There was curiosity. Everyone, unfortunately, felt left feeling a little bit, I'm not prepared for this.
Which is, by the way, an experience... You get that regularly when you work with Tim Kelly.
Is that right? Yeah, okay, right. That's not the intent.
Yeah, you're like, oh, yeah. Biting off a little bit more than can chew, yeah, but yeah.
That's okay. Then you just chew like hell.
Exactly.
It's fine. It's normal. And so a lot of the students were, you know, they had eyes like saucers in the session, at least from what I could see.
Mm.
But speaking with a lot of them and their teachers or their parents or whatever after it, and they're like, yeah, they, you know, it's not freaked them out, isn't the right way to say it. They felt a little bit overwhelmed, but they were also really excited by it. And yeah. I think that's probably the right response. I think that means that on the most part, we've probably got it. We probably hit it at the right level, because if it was too gently and they were like, well, you know, is that it? Yeah. Is that all there is? I didn't really want them being underwhelmed.
Yeah.
They need to have something to grow into.
I did feel like they were at the right level overwhelmed.
Yeah, good.
Having worked with you previously, see it in their faces.
Good.
Yeah.
Good, excellent. And obviously it's going to be, you know, this is a 10-something year program.
Yeah.
So for everybody that comes in subsequently, there will be all of this history now for them to be able to start digesting, and there'll be heaps of people that they can ask around, you know, how does it work and what do I do now, and, you know, I want to help with this thing, how would I do that? There should be a lot, although there will be an awful lot more guidance and direction around that, not just from me, but from what we've developed in terms of systems, but also all of the great people that are part of it too. I think trying to get the culture right from day one is really, really important too, and making sure that, you know, we've outlined the values. Now we just need to just that simple task of living by them, because, you know, it's really important how the people in the team treat their peers. that's ultimately going to define what the culture is. Anyway, it should be good. It's off to a good start. It'll keep us off the streets and out of mischief.
Yeah, and like you were saying, it's a bit like setting up a 70 people organization in one go.
In one go.
And to know that the spread also with experience is quite wide.
Very.
So even in my group, which was the Area Structures group, we had high school students all the way to uni, like third year uni students.
Yep.
So, I think it's going to be a good mix in that sense. Before you were talking about connecting students with industry, so I presume you can see quite a few gaps there where students perhaps don't have the level of understanding of what industry is actually about, and industry maybe has a gap about they're not connected enough to the student side of things, the new ideas coming in and the innovations, the fresh minds. Would that be on the right track there?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Like, I think industry needs, especially at the moment, the quantum of people that are needed by industry at the moment is really high, but it's with the right skill sets, and that's where a lot of it falls over, is that even after a whole bunch of study, very often the students still aren't really match fit for industry, and then industry has to go and either do an awful lot of training or just absorb the cost of somebody not really adding a whole lot of value for a significant period of time. And it just, just business and manufacturing Australia is already pretty hard. I don't think that we need to be doing that kind of thing when there's not really a need to. And it's really hard for education to stay contemporary because often the curriculum cycles are 7 years. And that's, sometimes that's optimistic in terms of the timeframes. So it's not like it's necessarily, I'm not casting the blame on anybody. I think one of the things that, we specifically wanted this student team to be is extracurricular, and there has been a lot of push to make it curricular. But then it's just, that's not the point. The complexity that adds is enormous. And again, it's a 7-year time frame to do that. And then you've got to start going through Education Queensland or whatever other, bureaucratic systems. Mm. And it's not meant to be, what we're doing at the moment, it's not really meant for the masses. It's meant for those, kids, students that want to go beyond themselves in a STEM domain and don't have an outlet for it currently. If it becomes something that's for everybody in the future, then that's great. But we don't have the resources to manage that at the moment anyway. So just, we've got to start. We have to start small, really, no matter what. It feels like the right way to do it, I think. So that's, from an industry perspective, industry really sees it as a talent pipeline for them. And I hope, we've got maybe 10 or something companies engaged with it now, which is great. Mm. Through a lot of their engagement, they'll start working with students that they'll want to poach, and they should. That's the purpose of it. It's kind of like a protracted, low effort interview process where the risk at both sides is really low because you've had a chance to work together for an extended period. And especially if you've got some of the kids we've got, they're in year nine. If they go and do a university degree and they stayed with a student team either full-time, like the entire time or on and off or whatever, but they'll come away with the better part of, 8 years of experience through that before they go into university. Or maybe they have 3 or 4 years and then they get an internship somewhere, like a permanent internship that, goes along with a study, or maybe it's work integrated learning or, whatever the case might be. So I think there's an awful lot of potential there. And on the flip side of that, students and parents and educators and even career counselors, especially in the STEM domain, they don't really have a good feeling for what industry actually needs at this point. And it makes it very difficult for them to start recommending how to do things. And if we want to start helping the top talent that's coming through schools to choose STEM and engineering and manufacturing as their career pathway, then we need to make it tangible and compelling. And we're not doing that. We don't have good mechanisms for that currently. So this is meant to be a mechanism to help to not just educate the kids through the process, but to educate teachers and parents as much as the kids around this is what industry is actually doing and this is what industry actually wants. And these are the things that you would need to do in order to engage with that. So I don't know. I think I'm really positive about it. I think it's shaping up really nicely. Couldn't have really asked for it to be any better, to be honest.
Mm. Oh. Yeah. Main takeaway is pleasantly surprised with the level of engagement.
Yes.
Very good. All right, Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, this excellent podcast.
Thanks, mate.
And for the beer.
Folks, this is all we have time for. If you got something out of this episode, please subscribe, share, and review. We are also always keen to hear your thoughts via the details in the description. And do keep an eye out for the next episode. Until then, upwards and onwards.